This year's festival promises to be bigger and better than ever. If you would like to join us as a vendor, reader, or body healer, please call 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. Once again, that's call us at 313-317-6540 or email us at holistic2010@peoplepc.com. We hope you are able to join us at this fantastic festival.
Hi, this is former Downriver resident Steve Chesney, and every time I'm in Dearborn, I listen to Mike Darinowski, Scrockin' Your
Batow,
every Sunday night from 7 until 9 p.m. on the only station making waves, WHFR,
Dearborn.
Very professional.
Hello, this is CD the DJ. Please join me every Sunday from 1 to 3 p.m. as I bring you the world of music, where we travel the world in search of your kind of music from all parts of the world, where we're making waves at WHFR. So come travel with me and enjoy the journey.
This is Dr. Wally B. from Cat Daddy in the 1320s, and you are listening to WHFR Dearborn, making waves.
Are you thinking about getting your GED diploma? Well, here at the GED Pep Talk Center, we've got a number of pep talks that can motivate you.
Sometimes things don't always turn out the way you want them to.
You know that feeling? People look at you and don't believe in you.
You want some gentle encouragement. Then you're on your way to your GED diploma and a better life.
But I know you're probably just a little bit nervous.
You can find it in yourself to take that first step.
You can improve your future.
You can do this. I know you can.
You need to start pushing yourself.
Now get your game face on and take the first step towards a better life. Hurry up! Don't make me repeat myself.
Whatever level of motivation you need to get your GED diploma, we've got a pep talk that's right for you. Call 1-877-38-YOUR-GED or visit yourged.org for your pep talk and find free GED classes in your area. GED is a registered trademark of the American Council on Education, brought to you by Dollar General Literacy Foundation and the Ad Council.
A very important key in keeping a healthy lifestyle is fitness. Why not condition yourself as well as your mind here at Henry Ford Community College? The Health and Physical Education curriculum offers both a 2-year Associate's in Applied Science as well as a certificate program, both offering a wide variety of courses including exercise physiology, nutrition, and physical conditioning. For more information, you can call 313-845-6318 or on the web at hfcc.edu/programs.
This is Gold Mike Holloway inviting all of you loyal listeners to shake that thing with those rock and blues on the Go With The Flow Mike Holloway Show every Tuesday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. right here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Yeah! Yeah.
Ow!
Earth Sky. Welcome to Earth Sky 22, your weekly mix of science and music from Austin, Texas. I'm Michael Brennan. This week, asteroid 2012 DA14 does a close flyby, and we'll talk to Deborah Bird about that. NASA launches its Landsat data continuity mission, and songs by Tao and the Get Down Stay Down. Here's your scientist soundbite.
There are these objects out there, and astronomers are watching for them. This object will be passing near us on February 15th, 2013.
That's Deborah Bird talking about asteroid 2012 DA14. More with her in a few. But first, Song of the Week is by Tao and the Get Down, Stay Down. The track is called We the Common, and it's off their new album, released this week.
If I burn my youth, would it come to me? Oh, love, won't you bat my eye?
miss the sweet garden man, baffled a skeleton drive. All they wanted was a villain, and all they had was me. All they wanted was a villain, so then they just took me. Hold my county line, get down on my city floor. A skeleton dry. All they wanted was a villain, and all they had was me. All they wanted was a villain, so then they just took me. Hold my county line, get down on my city floor.
That was We the Common by Tao and the Get Down Stay Down on their album out this week. You're listening to Earth Sky 22. You can find us as Earth Sky on Facebook, Earth Sky Science on Twitter, and at earthsky.org. Deborah Bird is in the studio now to talk about asteroid 2012 DA14. Welcome, Deborah.
Hi, Mike. So if you haven't heard of this asteroid yet, you must be living on the moon because there's so many people talking about this asteroid. So it's interesting because this asteroid is probably one of millions of asteroids that have passed close to Earth in our 4.5 billion year history. But what's new now is that astronomers are watching for asteroids like this. So when one passes particularly close to us, we know about it in advance. And that's the case here.
And so they just put a name, they just discovered this asteroid in 2012, but it's been out there probably for eons.
4.5 billion years, just like us. Yeah, this asteroid's part of our solar system, and all the things in the solar system, you know, formed at about the same time. So the thing about this asteroid is that it has an orbit that's somewhat similar to Earth's. So it's considered a near-Earth asteroid, and it's passed near us many times. But, you know, as I said, now astronomers in the past few decades have gotten more and more serious about watching for asteroids, near-Earth asteroids. And we know, for example, that asteroids do sometimes strike the Earth. For example, Meteor Crater, which is a huge crater that's carved into the ground near, it's east of Flagstaff, Arizona. Very cool place to visit, especially with kids. And that was caused by an object that struck the Earth 50,000 years ago. More recently, we have the Tunguska event in 1908, and that, too, is an example of an object. It's usually described as a small comet, not an asteroid, thought to have exploded in the atmosphere and flattened forest and killed reindeer in Siberia. So asteroid 2012 DA14 is not alone. It's not unusual that there are these objects out there, and astronomers are watching for them. This object will be passing near us on February 15th, 2013.
And there's no chance of Earth impact.
NASA is saying that there is absolutely no chance of an Earth impact. But this object is getting very, very close. In fact, it's getting closer than geosynchronous satellites. So most satellites orbit just a few hundred miles up, but we have this special kind of satellite called a geosynchronous satellite, and also some communication satellites that are orbiting about 26,000 miles up. So they're orbiting much higher up than ordinary satellites. And this particular asteroid, 2012 DA14, is going to pass 17,200 miles from Earth. So it's coming within the orbit of those geosynchronous satellites.
Wow. So any chance it would hit one of those satellites?
You know, people, I think, don't realize how vast space is. Space is really big. So, wow, if it hit one of those satellites, that would be surprising. That would be very surprising. It's not very crowded up there at that height above the Earth.
So how big is this asteroid?
The asteroid's size isn't known very precisely. It's thought to be maybe 45 meters across, which is about 150 feet across. So the size of this object, if it hit us, it wouldn't destroy the planet, like it wouldn't break the planet into pieces or anything like that. People are comparing it to the Tunguska event, which I mentioned. And again, that Tunguska event in 1908, something happened in Siberia. It happened in a remote location, and it took scientists a long time to figure out actually what had happened there, because there were, you know, very few people on the ground there. But they know that in 1908, something happened to flatten. There was a big explosion, and something happened to flatten many miles of forest in Siberia and to kill the reindeer that were in that forest. And so nowadays people say it's a small comet. 2012 DA14 is thought to be on the order of that event. So if 2012 DA14 were to hit in Siberia, it would again flatten, you know, miles of forest and kill reindeer. Of course, you don't know where it's going to hit. So if it happened to hit on a city, it could flatten a city. And that's very, very sobering. Most of Earth is water, so chances are it would go into the water. But, you know, tsunamis, that sort of destruction. So, you know, it wouldn't be a good thing if it hit us. It would be a bad thing. But again, it's not going to hit us. It's not going to hit us on February 15th, 2013. It's going to pass within 17,200 miles of Earth, closer than the moon, closer than geosynchronous satellites, probably won't hit any satellites, probably definitely won't hit the moon. And, you know, that it's just something to really sort of, you know, think about. And
yeah, that seems pretty close. Is there any chance in future years that we're going to have an even closer encounter with this asteroid?
At first, astronomers thought that there was a possibility that it might hit us in the year 2020. But as they tracked the orbit of this object more thoroughly and got, you know, more data points in terms of, you know, what its orbit looks like, they've ruled out that possibility. So at this point, there are no known instances where this object will strike us. Of course, there are many, many objects, as I said, out in space that are passing near us. It seems like, you know, every couple of months, it seems like we're talking about an object, not that comes as close as this object does, but every couple of months, it seems like, or more often, it seems like we're talking on the website about some object, some asteroid or other that's coming somewhat close. So, you know, there are lots of these objects out there, and astronomers are watching for them. They're trying to find them all, track their orbits, find out if indeed one might be on a collision course with Earth. They say that it would take a couple of years to mount a spacecraft expedition to encounter an asteroid that would be on a collision course with Earth. And people ask that all the time. They say, well, couldn't we just, if we, you know, if we knew about it, couldn't we just, you know, go up there with a spacecraft and do the Bruce Willis thing and, you know, send it off course or blow it up into pieces or something like that. And the answer is, if we thought that one was on a collision course with Earth, I'm sure that we would try that. Would we have enough time to mount that expedition and to get that spacecraft up there? That's the question. So, you know, they're trying to find out. This is, if you ever have a chance to ask your congressperson about this funding for this type of thing, hey, I would vote yes. Let's keep funding this because, you know, it's definitely something that, in my mind is something we should keep an eye on. But there's nothing that's going to be happening on February 15th.
Okay. Are we going to be able to see anything here, standing on Earth here?
No, we're not even going to be able to see it. It's just going to sweep past. And and when I say us, I mean those of us who don't have telescopes. Now, astronomers that do have telescopes will be watching this object. It's just under the limit of visibility to the eye. So it'll definitely be visible through telescopes and binoculars, and people who have charts and so on and who are familiar with looking at the sky will be able to see it. In fact, there's going to be a really cool event where shortly after it's closest to Earth, it's thought that it'll pass into Earth's shadow for a while. So what that means is that, of course, the asteroid is shining with reflected sunlight, just as the Earth and the Moon are shining with reflected sunlight. It's not really emitting any light of its own. So when it passes into Earth's shadow, it'll suddenly go dark, and it'll be dark for something like 18 minutes, and then it'll suddenly, you know, come out of the shadow and reappear again. So definitely amateur astronomers who have telescopes and who are used to looking for events like that will be watching for that. It might be that if there's an astronomy club in your location, it would be a good time to check with them to see if they're going to have any kind of viewing party or something like that. You know, check it out. See if there's some way that you can see it. Other than that, I would say just watch for the videos and watch for the photos that are sure to come out of this event, because surely astronomers will be taking pictures.
Yeah, we'll have them on earthsky.org.
We definitely will.
All right, thanks a lot, Deborah.
Okay, thank you, Mike.
We're EarthSky, a clear voice for science. The Landsat series of Earth-observing satellites have had a satellite in orbit since 1972, and they'll continue the mission this week with the launch of the latest, most technically advanced Landsat satellite yet, the Landsat Data Continuity Mission, or LDCM. The launch will take place in California on February 11th. Watch the launch live at landsat.usgs.gov and join the online launch party by following USGS Landsat or NASA_Landsat on Twitter. EarthSky's Jorge Salazar spoke with several scientists about how they've used Landsat data over the years. Here's satellite researcher Curtis Woodcock.
The Landsat series of satellites has been absolutely fantastic, and this historical archive is really the key to understanding how forests are changing, because even though a lot of the imagery is yet to be analyzed or studied, it's available because it was collected. Somebody had the foresight in the past to collect global data that we can use now in the present time.
And this data, you say, has been collected since 1972, and it's still important for scientists now.
Oh, extremely important. I would argue that archive of data that, in essence, is a record of what's happened on the surface of the Earth may be the most valuable environmental data record that we have.
Here's NASA glaciologist Robert Binshather speaking about Landsat images taken from space of Antarctica, arranged in a full-color, high-definition mosaic.
This view of Antarctica from space, where you could see just gorgeous shades of blue and white and deep blue ocean, it was stunning.
Now, I'd like to speak with you about the Landsat image mosaic of Antarctica. LIMA shows an amazingly detailed view of the entire frozen continent. How would you describe LIMA?
Well, the way I would describe LIMA is that it is the first true color, high definition view of Antarctica.
Tell us more about some of the science that is contained in this.
Well, one of the most fascinating pieces of science that has been done with LIMA so far, in my opinion, was one that was totally unexpected. And this was one where they used the fact that it is in true color to assess where the penguin colonies, where the rookeries where penguins live, are located. And the way they did it was there's a unique spectral signature, a certain color to the guano, the penguin poo, if you will, that's deposited on the ice. So the fact that that Lima provided them true color and high resolution allowed them to assess where penguins were nesting and where they were not.
Maybe you could give us a big picture here of what was gained in doing this and why it's different than what scientists knew before this Landsat image mosaic of Antarctica was put together.
Well, I think the fact that it gives scientists an early view of any area of the continent. It's a huge continent, and most of it still remains unexplored in any sort of detail. So if you're a geologist wanting to explore a particular mountain range, you're going to want to look at that mountain range before you go. And then it also shows, because it's in such high detail, particular features on the surface that a glaciologist, such as myself, can interpret to tell us about the ice sheet, where it's going fast, where it's going slow, which direction it's going. So there's just a variety of ways that such a unique data set can be used by scientists. I can't remember who it was that said, you know, a good picture is worth a thousand words. It's true that in order to communicate our science, Landsat has a unique place that we can show people what's happening. We can see cities expand. In the polar regions, we can see these changes where nobody is even around to observe them. And for studying changes on this Earth and being able to interpret the causes of those changes, you want as long a time record as possible. And so Landsat has provided that.
Research scientist Martha Anderson speaking with Jorge Salazar about using Landsat to monitor water usage from space.
We know that fresh water availability is going to become an increasingly critical issue worldwide. So we really have to be able to map water use at the scale that water is being used. And Landsat really is the only satellite system currently operating that can provide us routinely and globally thermal information at this critical spatial scale.
How does Landsat, in orbit around Earth, see how water is being used on an agricultural field?
Well, Landsat has a number of imaging systems, and one of them collects radiation that is in the thermal wave band. Those are wavelengths that are longer than our eyes can see. All objects emit this kind of thermal radiation. The hotter the object, the stronger the thermal emission. So using these thermal wave band systems, we can map out the temperature of the land surface remotely. With Landsat, we can do this mapping at fine enough spatial resolution that we can detect temperature differences between different fields, agricultural fields, and this is very useful. Crops that are evaporating water with very high rate of ET tend to be cooler because the evaporation is cooling down the surface.
How is the water use information that Landsat collects being used?
It really is being used operationally now, and particularly in the western states where kind of water resources are getting increasingly tight and they're being depleted sometimes at an unsustainable rate. So in Idaho, for example, the water resource managers and the water management districts are using Landsat ET to see if individual irrigators in the irrigation districts are complying with their allocated water rights or if they're using more water than they should be. And they can tell that by looking at time sequences of Landsat ET data. Farmers can use this information also to figure out which fields need to be irrigated and by how much they need to be irrigated. We can also study kind of the trade-offs in water use between different users. For example, in some parts of the West, you have irrigation occurring next to a stream that's supporting some important habitat, salmon spawning grounds, for example. We can use the Landsat ET to see how much the irrigated agriculture may be influencing the stream flow in these critical ecosystems.
Landsat's 40-year legacy continues on February 11th, 2013, as the Landsat Data Continuity Mission, or LDCM, prepares for launch. Here's Jim Irons, principal scientist, talking about LDCM.
The LDCM will extend and improve upon the Landsat record of landscape change The resulting observations and information will be critical to managing increasing demands on land resources and preparing for inevitable changes to the global land surface. LDCM will be the best Landsat satellite launched today, the best Landsat satellite ever, in terms of the quality and quantity of the data collected by the LDCM sensors. I do not think it hyperbole to suggest that this, all 7 billion of us will benefit from the results of the Landsat Data Continuity Mission.
Landsat Data Continuity Mission, set for launch February 11th. Watch the launch live at nasa.gov. And that's our show. Thanks for joining us. This week's show was recorded in EarthSky Studio in Austin, Texas. For more information about the music or the science you heard, visit EarthSky.org. I'm Michael Brennan. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next stage. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next stage.
For a lunchtime treat that is oh so sweet, get the Blues Time, Thursday, noon till 2 p.m. I'm Mr. White, here to rock your socks and rattle your seats. Try the Blues Time, Thursday, noon till 2, and get your wig fried for free.
We will not be an easy target. We will never roll over and let pain plan our day. Or let an ache tell us what we can and cannot do. We will not linger on the sofa. Ask somebody else to bring us the mail. Or take the parking space closest to the door. But what we will do is take action. We will plan ahead. We will protect our bodies and fight back by moving. Lace up our sneakers and grab our tennis rackets. We will bowl. We will do our morning laps and bike ride through Saturday afternoon. We will walk our dogs around the block. We will pass up the elevator and proudly take the stairs. Because arthritis can't beat us if we beat it first. In the fight against arthritis, you need a weapon. What's yours? To learn more, visit us at fightarthritispain.org. This message brought to you by the Arthritis Foundation and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College provides a strong foundation for students pursuing a career in education, offering a two-year associate's degree in pre-education as well as pre-secondary and special education. HFCC was one of only six community college programs studied by Recruiting New Teacher, Inc. and has been the model for other colleges around the nation. For more information about HFCC's pre-education degrees, please call 313-845-6430 or check out the pre-education program guide at hfcc.edu/programs.
It's noon in the midweek, and you take your break from school for lunchtime. Turn on the radio and to find nothing is on. Oh boy, time to push the indie button. This is Steve Homer. Tune in for the latest new tune from your favorite indie bands, notes from the indie world, who's coming to town, and a little bit odd to end at the same time in a fun two-hour show. So, I invite you to listen to Culture City Radio every Wednesday from noon to 2 on the only station making wave, WHFR 89.3 FM, and on WHFR.FM.
Mountain Stage, the internationally distributed weekly two-hour live performance program out of West Virginia and hosted by Larry Gross, has made the move to Wednesdays 6 to 8 p.m. Tune in for live folk, blues, bluegrass, and more right here on WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Again, that's Mountain Stage on its new night and time, Wednesdays 6 to 8, here on WHFR.FM.
I'm Joanne Porchunsko. Please join me on Fridays, 2 to 6 p.m., as I cruise with the blues down Highway 61 on WHFR.FM the station making waves.
Dig deeper. Local news and alternative views for Dearborn and the surrounding area on the new WHFR Journal every Friday from 1 to 2 p.m. and anytime as a podcast from WHFR.fm. Join our WHFR news team as we dig deeper, making waves.
DA 14 coming soon to a planet near you and to Planetary Radio. Welcome to the travel show that takes you to the final frontier. I'm Matt Kaplan of the Planetary Society. It isn't every week that a 45-meter space rock nearly nicks our world. That's why we're focusing once again on near-Earth asteroid 2012 DA 14. You'll hear highlights from a NASA press conference, along with comments from Bill Nye and DA 14 random space facts from Bruce Betts. Emily Lakdawala is looking elsewhere in the sky. She's our planetary evangelist. Emily, a couple of very interesting things to talk about, both of them involving resources, one of which I don't think you knew existed. But first, tell us about these newsletters that go way back to the Galileo mission.
That's right. This is actually my second blog post on the Galileo messengers. The first one was about a year ago, in which I covered the phase of Galileo's mission development from a blueprint to launch, which was a terribly difficult and challenging phase. Well, the next phase was from cruise to Jupiter arrival, and that was just as terrible and difficult because, of course, this was a mission that had a high-gain antenna that was supposed to unfold like an umbrella, and it didn't. And that was just one of many problems that it faced during its cruise from Earth to Venus, back to Earth twice, and then to Jupiter. And so this mission, it was difficult to read the newsletters, but in the end, kind of fun to summarize them. And now I'm looking forward to its orbital mission as chronicled in JPL's newsletters.
So that's in the blog. It's a February 5th entry in Emily's list of blog posts. Let's go to one of the more recent ones, slightly more recent, from the 8th of February. It's a whole new resource. Well, not new really, but new to you, I guess.
Well, it's new to me, and I guess it's relatively new to the web. And the wonderful thing about this space image resource is that the planet that we're looking at is Earth. The resource we're talking about is what's called the Landsat Look Viewer. Now, Landsat is a series of satellites that's been orbiting Earth since 1972. They're about to launch, and maybe by the time you listen to this, they will have launched the eighth such satellite called the Landsat Data Continuity Mission. And the wonderful thing about Landsat is that its camera systems have remained fundamentally similar since 1972. So it's formed this amazing four-decade-long record of change in the way that the Earth's surface appears and the way that we have been using Earth's surface, the way that land has been put to use. I was inspired by a tweet from an astronaut, Chris Hadfield, who looked out his window and saw this really funky-looking volcano. And so I looked up the same volcano in Landsat imagery, and I walked people through how you can get these Landsat data and how you can process them and make them into pretty pictures that you can share with each other.
Is it difficult to use?
It's extremely easy to browse. It's wonderful because you can actually just type a place name into the browser and it'll take you right to that place. And it's very easy to go backward and forward in time, which is wonderful. You can see how the land has changed with time. You can see the ebb and flow of seasons. You can see different kinds of cloud cover, and the clouds are really fun to look at as well. It's a little harder to get the data out of it, but it's certainly extremely easy to browse, and I think that everybody should go check it out.
And Emily does give you a step-by-step guide to Landsat Look. That's what it's called. We'll give you the URL at planetary.org/radio on the page for this show. But you can also just go to that blog entry at planetary.org, and she's got all the instructions there and some of the examples of this rather magnificent volcano from directly overhead. Emily, thanks as always.
Thank you, Matt.
She is a senior editor for the Planetary Society and our planetary evangelist, also a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. And when you're on the blog, watch for her announcements of her upcoming Google Plus Hangouts. She does those every other week, alternating with Casey Dreyer, her colleague at the Planetary Society. Coming up next is the CEO of the Planetary Society, Bill Nye, the science guy.
Bill, the big news in space this week, you don't have to go very far. It's very close to our home planet.
That's right, Matt. It's 17,000 nautical miles. It's halfway to geosynchronous satellite orbits. This asteroid, 2012 DA14, was discovered last year by people in La Sagra, Spain, who received a grant from us at the Planetary Society for a camera that allowed them to photograph this thing that's moving relatively fast. This is 45 meters. It's big. It's half a soccer field. It's about the size of the thing that hit in Tunguska in Siberia in 1908. It blew down trees over 2,000 square kilometers. I mean, people, if this were to hit Paris or Tokyo or New York or Oklahoma City, that's it. I mean, those places are wiped out, out, out. Our colleague Ed Liu, the astronaut and a former Cornelian, a fellow Cornelian, remarks, it's like Control-Alt-Delete for the economy. This is quite a thing, and you'll be able to see it. Skilled people will be able to see it with binoculars and stuff.
Yeah, yeah, just beyond what you could see with the naked eye, yeah. I suppose.
And these things are like pieces of charcoal. I mean, they don't reflect very much light. So it's quite an achievement by our colleagues in La Sagra, Spain, to find the thing last year, last time we passed by this part of the Earth's orbit.
Thanks to that camera.
That's right. So this really is a time for everybody to celebrate the diligence of space explorers who use telescopes from the Earth. And it's also a time, I strongly feel, Matt, for everybody on Earth to just take a second. Wow, we just dodged a bullet. And I know there's a lot of talk of bullets these days, but I mean, this is serious business. If one of these things, and there are about 100,000 of them out there of comparable size and speed, if one of these things were to hit us, man, it is serious biz. It's like ancient dinosaur kind of stuff. I'm excited about it, and I'm stroking my chin about the future. It's an important time.
And we're going to hear more about this from the NASA media teleconference that took place last week. Some other very interesting thoughts about this pass by this rather large rock, which fortunately is not going to be hitting us. Not this time.
Not this time.
Bill, thanks very much.
Thank you, Matt.
He is the CEO of the Planetary Society. That's Bill Nye, the Science Guy. On Thursday, February 7th, NASA invited reporters, including yours truly, to join a media conference about asteroid 2012 DA14. It was just 8 days before the near-Earth object would pass inside the orbit of some communication satellites. The space agency gathered several of our planet's top experts on asteroids, including Lindley Johnson, program executive for the Near-Earth Objects Observation Program at NASA headquarters in Washington, D.C.
We have made a lot of progress over the decade in finding these objects. We probably would not have found DA-14 10 years ago, as we have, and not known about this close approach. But we still have a lot of improvement to do in finding all of the hazardous asteroids.
Amy Mainzer is principal investigator for the NEOWISE mission at the Jet Propulsion Lab near Pasadena, California. The NEO stands for Near-Earth Object, but it also meant a new lease on life for a spacecraft that had already completed another mission, the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer.
And in late 2009, NASA launched a satellite called WISE. WISE's primary mission was to just provide a survey of the whole sky in thermal infrared wavelengths. And these are wavelengths of light that human beings perceive as heat. Now, it so happens that observing in thermal infrared is actually a good way to find near-Earth objects. Because they get close to the sun, they are warmed by the sun, and therefore they glow brightly at thermal infrared wavelengths. But because an infrared telescope is sensing the heat emitted by the objects, the dark asteroid appears just as bright to the infrared telescope. So that's one advantage of doing these surveys at infrared wavelengths. And furthermore, a telescope that's orbiting in space can observe objects that are interior to the Earth's orbit much more efficiently than ground-based telescopes can, because ground-based telescopes usually have to look at night. So NASA's Near-Earth Object Program Office has worked closely with the WISE team to harvest the data from this mission to search for new near-Earth objects and to, you know, gather more information that's allowed us to estimate our progress toward the overall goal of finding as many of these potentially hazardous objects that we can. Aside from providing copious information about asteroids in general and near-Earth objects in particular, the NEOWISE project has really demonstrated the potential for a long-duration mission to search for smaller objects that might come close to the Earth. And these objects are interesting, of course, because not just the hazard that they might represent, but also because they may represent very attractive targets for future exploration, particularly with astronauts. There is another technique that astronomers can use to obtain very detailed physical measurements of asteroids if they come close enough to the Earth. So this is where we actually take a telescope and bounce radar waves off of an asteroid. And this provides us a very precise estimates of an object's orbit, and in certain cases, you can actually see very detailed information about its shape and its surface properties. So these observations are made possible with funding from the NASA Near Earth Object Observations Program, and they involve the use of radio telescopes at Arecibo in Puerto Rico and the JPL-managed Goldstone Telescope Complex in California. And in addition to providing really improved orbital data, radar gives us really neat information about the shape and rotation of the asteroids. We can even observe the rotation directly, and these are some of the best data that you can get short of actually flying a spacecraft to an asteroid like this. So where are we today with our understanding of the population of hazardous asteroids? Well, over the last 10 years of ground-based observations, we've vastly increased our understanding of the population of the largest objects. And, you know, our inventory of the main belt, the asteroids between Mars and Jupiter, has really increased dramatically by about a factor of 5.
Amy Mainzer then introduced Edward Bayshore of the University of Arizona, Tucson. He's the deputy principal investigator for OSIRIS-REx. That's Origins Spectral Interpretation Resource Identification Security Regolith Explorer, the rather strained acronym for an exciting mission still to come.
You know, this is all really cool stuff we're hearing about. And the goal of these programs, especially the goal of the survey programs, has been to find hazardous objects early enough so that we have time to carefully study it and we can design a strategy to deal with the threat. And if time allows, we'll certainly want to launch a space probe to the asteroid to study it up close. It's a mission to launch a probe to a near-Earth object. We'll launch in 2016. And we think this is going to be a pathfinder for all future missions to asteroids. The University of Arizona here in Tucson, along with the Goddard Space Flight Center in Greenbelt, Maryland, and the Lockheed Martin Company in Denver, have partnered together to develop and operate this mission. We call it OSIRIS-REx, and it will arrive at asteroid 1999 RQ36 in late 2018, where we will study it for about 6 months, and then we're going to carefully approach the asteroid to obtain a sample and return it here to the Earth in 2023. And by the way, this is going to be the largest sample of an extraterrestrial object returned to Earth since the end of the Apollo missions over 40 years ago.
Edward Bayshore of the OSIRIS-REx mission. He'll return in a minute along with other participants in NASA's asteroid flyby briefing. This is Planetary Radio.
Hey, Bill Nye here, CEO of the Planetary Society, speaking to you from Planet Fest 2012, the celebration of the Mars Science Laboratory rover Curiosity landing on the surface of Mars. This is taking us our next steps in following the water in the search for life to understand those two deep questions. Where did we come from, and are we alone? This is the most exciting thing that people do, and together we can advocate for planetary science and, dare I say it, change the world.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're about to return to NASA's February 7 briefing on our encounter with near-Earth asteroid 2012 DA14. Edward Bayshore is telling us about the OSIRIS-REx mission that will visit a different asteroid in 2018 and then return a good-sized sample of it 5 years later.
Now, OSIRIS-REx is a science mission. RQ36 is a primitive asteroid that we believe is composed of materials that are almost identical to those that were present when the solar system was formed about 4.5 billion years ago. So with a sample, we'll be in a much better position to address many of the fundamental questions about the original chemistry of the solar system, including the sources of organics and water that gave rise to life here on Earth. But our mission will also be pioneering some really important technical capabilities that we'll need to work near asteroids. The force of gravity from the asteroid that we're going to visit is very tiny. And for OSIRIS-REx, the force of sunlight pushing on the spacecraft will be comparable to the gravitational force from the asteroid. And so it's going to be kind of like trying to handle a small boat in the wind, and that's not always easy. It can complicate things. And so we're developing techniques and processes that we'll need to, you know, to actually move around an asteroid and operate around an asteroid, particularly if we send a probe to an asteroid that might be on a collision course with the Earth. And by the way, the target asteroid for OSIRIS-REx is also a near-Earth object, and it would be very useful for us to be able to improve our understanding of the threat that that asteroid represents and to improve our ability to predict the orbits of other asteroids, other near-Earth asteroids. Our mission will help us do that by obtaining a more precise understanding of something called the Yarkovsky effect. And it's really very simple. It's a force that's created by the absorption of sunlight and the re-radiation of that energy as heat. And the heat acts like a tiny rocket thrust that can literally push asteroids out of otherwise harmless orbits and initiate their transport into the inner solar system where they can become hazardous. So aside from understanding how near-Earth objects are formed, the OSIRIS-REx mission should help us improve our long-range predictions of orbits of these objects and allow us to more accurately calculate the likelihood of a collision. And so in addition to the vigorous programs of discovery and close study of near-Earth objects that NASA's been conducting for over 15 years, the OSIRIS-REx mission will visit one up close to study the forces that make them dangerous in the first place, and will also bring back a sample for scrutiny here on Earth. Our adventure starts in 2016, and I invite you all to stay tuned for that.
Amy Mainzer of the NEOWISE mission then rejoined Edward Bayshore to provide some near-Earth asteroid basics, including a review of how these originally quite distant space rocks end up crossing the path of our planet.
Most asteroids in the solar system are stable, and they are in the main asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter, and they stay there for billions of years in most cases. But occasionally, some forces, some are gravitational and others are non-gravitational, like that slight push from solar radiation that Ed Bayshore described, the Yarkovsky force. These can kind of act to drift objects in from the main belt, and sometimes they hit gravitational resonances, which act like little flippers in a pinball machine. And sometimes these can inject asteroids from the main belt into near-Earth space. And this process happens relatively rapidly. While the main belt asteroids have been there for billions of years in most cases, the near-Earth object population is by comparison, relatively young. Most objects that enter the space around Earth's orbit don't last there very long. They stay for maybe a few million years to a few tens of millions of years. Now, we know that that means because this population is so young and the main belt asteroids are so old, that means there must be a continual supply of objects feeding in from different places in the main belt. We also know that some fraction of the near-Earth objects are cometary in origin, so meaning they come from more distant parts of our solar system, and they also make their way into near-Earth space. And so we're really trying to understand the exact mechanisms by which these migrations happen, and that's one of the many reasons we like studying the near-Earth objects.
And this is Ed Bayshore. I'm just going to chime in really quickly. As I had mentioned before, one of the goals of the OSIRIS-REx mission is to measure this Yarkovsky effect much more precisely. Just about a year ago, one of our team members, Steve Chesley from JPL, did a really exquisite set of measurements using radar data and came up with a preliminary estimate for the kinds of forces on our asteroid, RQ-36. That we're talking about, and he equated it to the force that you feel when you hold a couple of grapes in your hand. But that force applied over millions of years can literally move these mountains of rock around. And so, it's really quite important for us to make sure we understand this force much better, because we believe it'll improve our ability to predict the orbits of these hazardous objects.
We'll close with a question I asked Tim Spahr about the so-called amateur astronomers at Spain's La Sagra Observatory who discovered 2012 DA14. Tim directs the Minor Planet Center, the clearinghouse for discovery and tracking of pretty much everything in our solar system that is smaller than a full-size planet.
My understanding was that for an object that is moving this fast, at least relative to the Earth, that it presents some special challenges, and that some of the amateur observers, like La Sagra, maybe sort of optimize their searches for these objects. Is that not necessarily the case?
Lesagra, you know, I use the term amateur loosely. This is a bunch of highly skilled people with professional skills that originally were just paying to run their survey, and they also got a Planetary Society grant for the CCD. That's one thing to mention. They are currently doing work tracking space debris, which moves much faster than the average near-Earth asteroid along the sky. And so they are set up perfectly to do this kind of work. The translation of amateur into some other languages has caused me some problems at the Minor Planet Center, and I would reiterate that these people are professional skill level people that are unbelievably impressive what these so-called amateurs do. I also need to address one thing. I went back and looked at my data set, and no NASA survey had discovery type images of this object, and I suspect it was because it moved through the main survey window extremely rapidly, and this object ended up nearly over the pole of the Earth in the sky. And so it was not discovered, not picked up in a NASA survey as a discovery type image, although I expect it will be this time.
Tim Spahr closing out our brief collection of highlights from NASA's February 7 media briefing about 2012 DA-14. But wait, there's more. Bruce Betts joins me in a moment. Time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society, to tell us what is up. What is up in the night sky?
Hey, Matt, what you been doing?
Bruce knows that we delayed over 45 minutes because I could not tear myself away from watching the least competent leaf blower operator on our home planet who was working across the street, and it was too loud for us to record.
I couldn't stop watching Matt watch the leaf blower, so it was just catastrophic.
It was like a bad movie late night in your hotel room, and you can't tear yourself away. You can't stop watching it.
I enjoyed that you kept giving play-by-plays and critiques of his work.
Oh, listen, as one of our colleagues said, I should have put him on YouTube because it would have gone viral.
Maybe with a little editing. Speaking of editing, so you have to do less. Let me talk about the night sky. Jupiter is still the easy thing to see in the evening sky. Bright, bright, bright star-like object over in the southeast in the early evening. Mercury coming up a little higher through mid-February. Always tough to get Mercury. Got to look low in the west in the early evening. Well, I'll come back in random space fact to the other object we keep talking about.
Oh, yeah.
Let's move on now to This Week in Space History. It was 2001, this week, that Shoemaker Near Orbiter landed on the near-Earth object Eros almost exactly 1 year after going into orbit. And, of course, the amusing part of the story is it was an orbiter that they went ahead and figured, hey, end of mission life, what the heck, let's see if we can land. And they did, and they lived.
Yeah.
They got some cool data, particularly the fields data that being close really helps you out.
Was this a landing, a real landing, or was it more of a bump?
It's more of a gentle rest.
Yeah, okay. A rendezvous.
Low, low, low gravity. That helps you not go splat.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we move on to dun, 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 random space fact.
You really should be doing voiceovers for video games.
One night only, SmackDown, February 15th, 2012, DA-14 versus Earth.
Can I say it?
Please do.
Be there!
All right, we keep talking about 2012 DA-14, but darn it, it's worth it. The asteroid having a closest approach on February 15th, 2013 at 1925 UT for those in places like Europe and Asia and Australia and Africa. Not naked eye visible, but is visible, though challenging to track it across the sky with a telescope or binoculars. It'll be 27,000 kilometers, about 17,000 miles away at closest approach. Here are some more random space facts about 2012 DA-14. It will be moving about 1 degree per minute, or about 2 moon diameters per minute at closest approach. It'll be closer than geosynchronous satellites. The encounter will alter the asteroid's orbit considerably. This will teach it to mess with Earth. It will shorten its period, its year, from 368 to 317 days. We expect an object on average to fly by of this size on average, every 40 years, the impact every 1,000, every 1,200 years. But as I mentioned, it could be tomorrow, could be 5,000 years from now. But asteroids don't really respect averages. We asked you previously, near-Earth asteroid related, what is the largest known near-Earth asteroid, formal definition of asteroids that come within 1.3 AU of the Sun, astronomical units, average Earth Sun distance. How do we do, Matt?
And how well timed it was. Lots and lots of entries, people using our new form. Our winner is Jim Elliott of Sanford, North Carolina. First time winner, as far as I can tell, who has been entering for a long time. He said it was asteroid 1036 Ganymede, not Ganymede, Ganymede, not to be confused with that moon much farther out in the solar system, at 32 kilometers in diameter.
It's a healthy-sized beast. Ganymede, although interesting as I was looking into this, Ganymede is the German spelling of Ganymede, the Trojan prince turned god, whom Zeus designated as the cupbearer to the gods. So Jupiter's moon Ganymede is actually named after the same mythological character, but different spelling.
By the way, he added, Jim Elliott did, a great interview a couple of weeks ago. This was with Deborah Fisher. He said, Dr. Fisher needs to be running programs at NASA. Faster, better, cheaper is right up her alley. I just thought I love that little comment. So
it is indeed, but speaking as someone who's worked at NASA headquarters, it's probably really good to have Deborah out in the field doing science.
Yeah. Jim, we're going to get you Bill Nye's voice on your answering machine. There's a cool prize. It's been very, very popular. I got a couple of other comments I got to read to you. Mark Wilson said, the near-Earth asteroid from the film Armageddon was the size of Texas, and even after Bruce Willis broke it up into two halves at the end of the movie, both of those were much larger, so it's time to update our records.
Wow, that is a really good point.
I like Kurt Lewis's point even better. He wants asteroids with this type of orbit, approaching Earth and then returning to the belt, they should be used to ferry astronauts to Jupiter so that we can explore Europa. And he said, send Bruce Willis. So Bruce Willis gets two mentions in this week's show. But you're going to love this one. Unrelated, from Georgi Petrov. He wanted to know, if he wins, could he have your voice instead of Bill's?
My voice? Yeah.
Be
of course,
there.
Guess he didn't win, but he should have.
Next time.
Yeah. Why aren't we giving away my voice? Lo, 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 lo.
Okay, get on with it. We're late.
All right. Here's a little bonus for those of you who actually listen to our show and don't try to cheat by just checking out the trivia contest on the website. This one is for you, and that's the hint. Planetary Radio listeners. According to Discoverer Jaime Noman, where was the human observer when the discovery of 2012 DA14 was made? And I'm looking for what type of place, not a specific geographic location. It was a place you would not typically think of an observer being at the time of an asteroid discovery.
Excellent question. You have until the 18th, that would be Monday, February 18th, at 2 p.m. Pacific time to get us this answer.
Quick note, check out my introductory astronomy and planetary science class. Did the first lecture this last week. Tour the solar system. Go to planetary.org/betsclass.
And I look forward to joining you there. And what would it be? On the 13th,
yes.
For anybody who hears this very early on, you can catch the Bruce and Matt show.
You can watch next week's What's Up being recorded.
That's right.
On video. Live.
Wait a minute. Be there!
All right, everybody, go out there, look up in the night sky, and think about leaf blowers. Thank you, and good night.
I can't get it out of my head. He's Bruce Betts, the Director of Projects for the Planetary Society. He joins us every week here for What's Up. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation, and by the out-of-this-world members of the Planetary Society, Clear Skies.
I'm working two jobs, and my husband works too. My kids go to school with your kids. I'm one out of every six Americans, and my family is struggling with hunger. I believe in this country, but it's hard to believe so many Americans have to choose between paying bills and feeding families.
Visit feedingamerica.org and find your local food bank. Every dollar you donate helps provide 7 meals for those struggling with hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Henry Ford Community College has a medical practice clinical management degree program that will prepare you for a rewarding career in the exciting field of healthcare. You can earn a certificate as a medical office assistant or a 2-year degree in medical office management. For more information, give us a call at 800-585-HFCC.
Think you have what it takes? We do. Henry Ford Community College. Visit us online at hfcc.edu.
Tuesday, between the hours of 6 and 10, the sounds of creative, improvised music come your way on the Spirits Rejoice radio program, right here on Henry Ford Community College Radio, WHFR, Dearborn. Tune in.
This is Tamara Bedricki, and you're listening to WHFR, Dearborn, where the music rocks.
You're listening to WHFR Dearborn. Perhaps you're joining us online at WHFR.fm from somewhere around the world, or locally perhaps, right here in the Metro Detroit area at 89.3 FM. Either way, we're glad you're here and hope you're enjoying this lovely classical programming. Some other program notes to share you might want to check out here at WHFR. Mondays from 1 until 4 p.m., it's swing time, the best in swing music just for you. Tuesday nights at midnight, it's the Circle Within, playing rock and blues. On Wednesdays from 6 until 8 p.m., it's Mountain Stage, country, folk, Americana music at its best. On Thursdays from 4 to 5, it's Motor, and from 5 to 6, the Motor Live Drive at 5, a live local band performing in studio each week just for you. Friday from 10 to midnight, it is Smooth Grooves Jazz. As you can see, we have such an eclectic lineup of programming, we could go on and on. Just check us out sometime, and we thank you for listening.
Here's the third movement from the Flute Concerto in D by Johanna Grell. This is Maria Bonilla with Concerto Copenhagen. Andrew Manzi conducts.